From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And big news out of Washington today. President Trump says he's fired National Security Advisor John Bolton. The firing by tweet came days after President Trump tweeted that he would not be holding previously secret talks with the Taliban at Camp David. This was during the anniversary week of 9/11 terror attacks. Bolton reportedly vehemently opposed that meeting. And by the way, Bolton says today he wasn't fired, he quit. Let's bring in NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman at the State Department. Michelle, as you know, this was announced an hour after the White House said Bolton would be joining Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin in giving a briefing. What's your sense of what's going on inside the administration?
Well, a lot of confusion, obviously. You know, we had heard that Pompeo and Mnuchin would be there, and then they announced that Bolton would join. And then minutes later, we saw the tweets from President Trump, who said that Bolton's services are no longer needed at the White House, that he strongly disagreed with many of his suggestions, as did others in the administration. He said he asked for Bolton's resignation last night and was given it to him this morning.
Well, and Bolton, of course, tweeting out that he resigned. He has been sidelined for a while now in that what we reportedly saw was a hot meeting, a hot debate about whether or not to have the Taliban at Camp David. He was being beamed into the meeting. He was in Warsaw. He hasn't been involved in, you know, even, you know, things like relations with North Korea. Was there a sense that this was a breaking point with the Camp David meeting? Because the president could have gone ahead and had the meeting if he wanted it.
That's right. Well, I mean, the White House press secretary today is claiming that there weren't any particular breaking points, that there were many, many issues. There have been issues building up over time. You mentioned a couple of them. Afghanistan, he seemed to have been sidelined on that. And he certainly did not agree with the efforts by the State Department to reach a deal with the Taliban or with this idea of having Camp David talks. And, you know, there's also differences over North Korea, over Iran. You know, Bolton's a really hardliner on all of these issues. And he often seems out of step with a president who says things like, you know, I'm willing to meet with Iran's president and you know, has and repeats that over and over again.
Well, Bolton is a well-known hawk. You know, and since his hiring, people have been asking, as the president is trying to have these meetings with, you know, leaders of North Korea and, as you mentioned, maybe even Iran, that it's known that that was oil and water.
But, you know, in some ways, Robin, I think it was useful for Trump to have him around. You know, I had heard stories about how he would meet with Western leaders and say, here's my national security advisor, John Bolton. This guy wants to get me into a war, but he's not going to. So it was useful to have that kind of viewpoint around, maybe to scare people off a bit.
Good cop, bad cop. Yeah,
exactly. But at the same time, you know, Bolton is a guy who knows how to get things done. He accomplished a lot of his agenda while he was in this position. They, of course, right away after he came into office, they pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. They've reimposed sanctions. They've stopped any oil waivers. They've put pressure on everyone, including U.S. allies, to stop buying oil from Iran. And then there's other things. You know, they pulled out of the Cold War era arms control treaty, the INF. Bolton launched this campaign against the International Criminal Court. They've been thinking about how to fund the UN differently. So, you know, he has accomplished a lot behind the scenes because he is kind of understands how government works and is kind of a good political infighter, you might say.
We just have about a minute here. Difficult time for this. The peace talks now off in Afghanistan. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu declaring he wants to annex the Jordan Valley if he's reelected. You've got Brexit. We hear Senator Mitt Romney is criticizing the firing, Senator Rand Paul praising it. What's it feeling like for you at the State Department?
Well, there's to add to your list, there's also the UN General Assembly coming up later this month. Mm-hmm. And that's the chance when all these world leaders come to New York and have a chance to meet. And we've seen the French president seems to be trying to arrange some sort of encounter between Trump and Iran's President Rouhani at that meeting. So, yes, there's a lot going on and a lot of uncertainty with the president's own national security team. We don't know who's going to replace Bolton at this time. We don't even know who's going to be there temporarily. A lot of uncertainty.
Michelle Kellerman, NPR diplomatic correspondent at the State Department there. Michelle, thank you so much.
Sure thing.
Well, speaking of uncertainty, let's go to London now, where British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said today he's going to get a deal and take the UK out of the European Union on October 31st. He spoke after Parliament was suspended early this morning, a move lawmakers protested with chants of no and shame. Joining us now is Bronwyn Maddox, who is director of the Institute for Government in London. Bronwyn, many people are saying this is now a potentially a constitutional crisis. They're worried that Johnson won't obey a law that just passed that says he can't do a no-deal Brexit. How real is that concern?
I think at this point, there isn't a real concern, or shouldn't be, that the government is not going to obey the law. Even though there were rumblings about this, no, the government has come out and said, yeah, we will obey the law. What they're looking for is legal loopholes to say that there might be a way round doing what Parliament has just passed a law to oblige the government to do, and that's to go to the European Union and ask for an extension from October 31st. But I don't think that there's a question at this point that the government would actually defy the law. We would then, though, be in even more of a constitutional crisis than we are at the moment.
But you're saying that they could find some loophole, so they could actually, the government could have a no-deal Brexit on the 31st if they find some way to make it legal to do that.
Well, it's possible in theory, and one of the things the government has been looking at is whether it could indeed go and ask for an extension, but not necessarily accept one. And so on. But we've got a long, long 5 weeks ahead of us. And one of the first things the government is probably going to now do is go to Brussels and explore a deal with possibly a bit more energy than it has done before.
So you think that the government is now going to seriously try to get a deal with the EU? Do you think that the EU is going to be receptive to doing a different deal than was rejected many times by Parliament when Theresa May was Prime Minister?
I think the Boris Johnson will at least go through the motions. I'm not sure how seriously, but I think he will go through the motions of looking to find a deal with the EU. And indeed, if he can find one, that gives him a way through this very slender set of options he now has. There are beginning to be talk of resurrecting something the EU offered before, which was it's called an all-Ireland backstop. That is really keeping Northern Ireland essentially in the single market and customs union. So treating the island of Ireland the same way, allowing goods to travel freely all around it. Now, that has been anathema to the DUP, who've been the government's coalition partners, or not quite formally coalition partners, but propping up the government in this. But they're slightly losing their power. And there is a sense that if there is a deal to be done, it is probably in that area, using different vocabulary and making it seem a bit more different from what Theresa May managed to get.
But wouldn't any deal that Johnson is able to strike with the EU, if he is able to do that, wouldn't that then have to go through Parliament? And isn't that sort of an impossible task, especially given that he doesn't even have a majority right now in Parliament?
Any deal has to go through Parliament. And if it's not Theresa May's deal, then it's a version of that saying we're out of the EU on these terms. That has to go through Parliament, no question. Would he get support for that? Well, it is possible. I think that even though he hasn't got a majority in his own party, there are a lot of MPs there who want a deal on both sides of the political aisle. And I think, indeed, if he did come back with a deal, it would be difficult for Labour, the main opposition, to oppose him on that. So he has got a chance there. But the main question would it split his cabinet and his own party even further? Because the very right-wing, sort of very pro-Brexit part of that party is the part that he's most allied with, and they're the ones who'd be most uneasy about a deal.
Let me just ask you one more thing, which is for those people in the UK who don't want Brexit to happen and are now feeling more confident that there's a possibility maybe of a second referendum, what do you think about that? Do you think that there is a possibility that the people will get another chance to vote on Brexit and maybe it wouldn't happen at all?
It is possible that there is going to be a second referendum. I think that's got quietly a bit more likely, having faded away over the summer months. And the reason it faded away was that there really weren't many MPs in Parliament pushing for that. The reason it's come back now is that the opposition is pushing for a general election and saying, and the Labour part of the opposition saying, look, if we get a general election, we will also have a second referendum. It might be the other side of a general election, and it might indeed be that the general election really took the place of that second referendum. I mean, it essentially was an election just about Brexit. But I think it's fair to say that that support in Parliament for a second referendum is rising, even though there are many people in the country that think one caused plenty of trouble put on top of a parliamentary democracy, and let's not have another one again for a very long time on anything.
That is Bronwyn Maddox, who is the director at the Institute for Government in London. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'm going to warn you now that this next segment might make you a little uncomfortable because we're going to be talking about death and dead bodies. Our guest, Caitlin Doughty, is an expert. She's a mortician and author who gets dozens of questions about death every day, including from kids. She's published some of those questions and her answers in the new book, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortals About Death. Caitlin Doughty joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, and first of all, you're a mortician. How did you get into this line of work? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was a bit of a morbid child myself. And as I got older, I graduated from college. I had a medieval history degree, which is, as you may know, not a huge asset in the job market at the current time. And when I was 22 years old, I got a job at a crematory in Oakland. I was the one actually in the warehouse cremating the bodies.
By choice.
And it was by choice, absolutely by choice. And I suddenly was exposed to the reality of death in America and what goes on behind the scenes. And instead of being horrified by it, all I wanted to do was tell people about it and let people know what would happen to their mother when she was cremated or buried or embalmed. And that's really formed the basis of my career, is letting people know what happens behind the scenes in the funeral industry and, frankly, what reforms the funeral industry could use.
Well, and you write in this book, many people, including me, believe that we can control some of our fears by embracing death, learning about it, and asking as many questions as possible.
I absolutely believe that. And it really works. I wouldn't be a public advocate for having open conversations about death if the feedback wasn't, you know what, I still have anxiety about death. I'm still not too excited about my own inevitable death. But knowing exactly what to expect, even if I'll be dead, knowing what happens during an embalming, knowing what decomposition looks like, paradoxically, knowing these nitty-gritty details about death and the dead body actually helps us fear death less. Hmm.
Why do you think so many people fear death so much, given that we all die eventually?
Well, of course, we're never going to solve the existential problem of death, the fact that it's terrifying that we will disappear into the ether and go who knows where at a certain point of our lives. But it's also cultural. I've been able to travel around the world and look at how other cultures look at death, and America is really one of the most intensely in denial, intensely committed to the idea of, I mean, even think about how we do a traditional wake when someone dies. We chemically preserve the body, we put makeup on the body, and you come in and you see the person almost in a simulacrum of how they were when they were living.
And they're sleeping, basically.
You're trying to make it look like they're sleeping. Exactly. And I personally, in my advocacy, I think a dead body should look like a dead body, cleaned up, eyes closed, mouth closed. But I think that if your dad's dead, you should know that he's dead. That is the reality. That is the new reality of the situation. And I think it's actually a positive thing for us to face death more directly and not dress it up and put makeup on it.
Okay, so let's get to some of the questions that you answer in your book, starting with the one that gives the book its title, When I Die, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Explain.
Spoiler, yes. So this question was actually the very first question that sparked the idea for this book. It was a young boy at an event that I was at, and he asked that question. And it was so brilliant because it's very specific, but also taps into this fear that adults also have, I think, that their beloved Mr. Fluffkin's cat or dog will eat their body when they die. And the reality is that they will eventually. These are animals. Cats share a huge percentage of their DNA with lions, and they will eat you if they do not have access to other food. And they'll usually go for the softer parts of your body, your lips, your eyelids, because they're easy access. And then eventually, they wouldn't go for your eyeballs first, but they might eventually get to your eyeballs. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. Obviously, we don't want you to end up in that situation when you die. But you're creating new life. You eat meat in your life, and now an animal is eating you when you die. I don't think it's that far away from the cycle of life that we should be a part of.
Caitlin, let's go on to the next question, which is, this is another question from your book. You talk about whether people's dead bodies can be claimed as property.
That's a very difficult question. In America, they're called something like quasi-property. And what that means is that nobody truly owns a dead body. The person who is the next of kin, meaning the wife or the son or whoever's closest to the dead person, can make all the decisions for the dead body, but nobody truly owns it. And it's in the public interest to bury a body in a respectful manner, cremate a body in a respectful manner. And this is important because it gets into questions like, why can't I just keep my dad's skull on the mantelpiece?
Do people want to do that?
Oh, yes, they do. Oh, if you knew how often I got that question.
Wow.
Why can't I prop dad up in the corner or taxidermy him? And the reason is because, yes, you're in charge of making decisions for your dad when he dies, but it's in a very, very narrow legal range of options: cremation, burial, donation to science. There's no deflesh and keep his skull on the mantelpiece or taxidermy him or give him a Viking funeral. Those just aren't on the list of state or mandated options for dad's dead body.
So you talk about cremation in this book, and you say something I never thought of, which is that when you're cremating a body, you have to watch out for pacemakers because they could act like a little bomb in the cremation oven.
Exactly. That's actually one of our biggest questions that we ask on our cremation forum is, did mom have a pacemaker? Because if it's not removed, the batteries that are inside of it contain so much compressed energy that once they're met with the 1800 degree flames of the cremation machine, they do explode. And as a crematory operator, former crematory operator, I would open the door of the cremation machine to watch the cremation process as it was happening, maybe move the body around to make it more efficient. And if I happen to be doing that and there's a pacemaker in there that we didn't catch, that could explode and potentially be very harmful for me or just the inside of the machine.
You talk about a Viking funeral, which is where you put a body into like a canoe or a boat and you push it out. And then you light it on fire. They did it in Game of Thrones with a flaming arrow. You say that's not possible. It wouldn't work.
Well, not only is it not possible, it's not really a Viking funeral. It's a Hollywood idea of a Viking funeral. And everybody has it. It's, you know, there is the boat and then you shoot the arrow and it goes up in flame. And then it's very dramatic and powerful. And I get why the imagery is so appealing to Hollywood. But the reality is that if you just had a simple wooden canoe or boat and you put a body on it and you set the whole thing on fire, the boat and the wood in the boat is going to cremate much faster than the dead body. So what you're going to have is a half-charred dead body just bobbing around in a municipal waterway somewhere, which is not your romantic idea of a complete Viking cremation. So it's just not logistically possible, nor is it the actual historical reality.
Okay, there are so many things in this book, which is, again, called Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortals About Death. But I have to ask you about another thing that you talk about in here, which is that if you die on an airplane, on a commercial flight, that they will actually want to keep you in your seat because they have nowhere to put you.
This is something that I didn't even really know until I started digging in and doing my research. I had always assumed that there was some protocol of, okay, someone dies on a plane, it's unavoidable, they wrap them up, they put them in the back galley, they have some sort of secret compartment. That's not true. Often, they will just leave the person in their seat. And if the airplane is overbooked, as so many airplanes are, and there's no additional seats, you may end up just continuing to sit next to this dead person that you do not know for the remainder of the flight.
Just because they've been cramming so many seats into these flights and trying to fill them up so they can make
exactly.
Someone,
it feels like a coffin already when you're flying. And now it could become a literal coffin because you have to sit next to a dead body, which blew my mind. And I think anytime there's been an emergency on a plane I've been on, I'm not a doctor. And I think about the only thing I'm really good for is being the person willing to sit next to the dead body after the death occurs because I'm very comfortable and I work with the dead.
Right.
I wouldn't be scared by it. It wouldn't be my ideal seatmate, but you know, I would volunteer. I would do what I had to do.
I wonder if we'd ever hear an announcement over the loudspeakers. Is there anybody who wants to sit next? Is there a mortician on board who wants to
sit next?
Is
there anyone incredibly comfortable with dead bodies on board? And I'm like, I raise my hand. I do my call button.
What do you want to do with your body when you die?
Oh, what a great question. Until it is legal to leave my body out to be eaten by animals, I want a green burial, which is just a simple burial. You dig a hole in the ground, pretty shallow. You put a shrouded body into the ground and you allow the natural process of decomposition to happen. And maybe I'll even become a tree or a bush.
That is Caitlin Doty, whose book is called Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? Big Questions from Tiny Mortals About Death. There's so much more in here. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And you can find an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org. Now that all crew members have been rescued from that cargo ship that overturned off the coast of Georgia, the question is, how do you move the ship out of a busy U.S. seaport? That would be St. Simon Sound, where the ship tipped over as it was leaving. It was reportedly carrying more than 4,000 vehicles. Let's bring in Douglas Martin. He's president and general manager of the Americas branch of Smit Salvage and director at Don John Smit. He's involved with the efforts to remove the carrier from the Sound, and he joins us now from the command center in Brunswick, Georgia. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, how do you get that ship out of the Sound?
Well, it's quite a process. It starts off with an assessment. So the vessel's been through quite a trauma. So there's been a fire on board, and obviously you can see it's a non-or normal way. So one is to see actually what the risks are presently with regards to possible reignition of a fire. And also what the risks are for pollution. But once we've got that all sorted out, we can end up with a detailed plan of what we're going to do. Generally speaking, it starts off with removal of the oil. So this way we mitigate risk to the environment. And from there, it goes into the detailed planning, which is generally considered to be a par-buckling operation, which is the uprighting of the ship.
Well, how do you upright a ship?
Well, it's basically a combination of buoyancy, ballast, and pull force. And together we create a righting moment, and that righting moment in the salvage world, we refer that as par-buckling a ship. And there's been some very famous par-buckling operations in the past, probably the most famous being the USS Oklahoma after Pearl Harbor.
And I imagine the technology has advanced pretty significantly since the 1940s.
Well, pulling is pulling. So the basic plan initially is to figure out how much you have to pull, how smart you can be to make it as minimal as possible, because that's always an easier task. And then from there, that's where the technology comes in, is to there's much better pullers out there than there were back in the 1940s.
Now, the port is currently closed to traffic, right?
I understand that that is the case, yes.
So how long do you think that that will be the case as you're trying to parbuckle this ship?
That's sort of not within our scope as far as controlling it. It will not have to be closed, in my opinion, for the full duration, but it's really a matter of public safety, which is outside of what we do. I think that once everyone is comfortable, things are organized a little bit better as far as the situation and what the risks are and what precautions will be needed for ships passing. I think that's really very imminently coming, is to some sort of schedule on the commerce.
And they'll just be able to go around?
The ship's not in the channel. You know, it's close, but it's not in. So there can be some coordination there.
Finally, let me just ask you, how does this compare to other things like this that you've done in the past? Is this just a day's work for you?
No, these are significant cases. I mean, you know, I've mentioned the Oklahoma as one, Herald of Free Enterprise. There's another ship called the Rockness. Those are all sort of examples of major engineering and also quite a bit of art and science together to make these things happen. So these are all significant projects, and it's a challenge. There's nothing easy about it.
That is Douglas Martin, who is president and general manager of the Americas branch of Smit Salvage and director of Don John Smit. Thank you so much and good luck.
Thank you very much, and it was nice talking to you.
President Trump's campaign manager is predicting a victory for the president in 2020 and maybe future victories for Trump's family. The AP reports that at the convention of Republican delegates in Indian Wells, California this past weekend, Brad Parscale told reporters that the Trump family dynasty will last for decades, which many interpreted it as at least one of his children will follow him into the Oval Office. And in this month's cover story of The Atlantic, McKay Coppins says the money has moved from Ivanka to Don Jr. McKay Coppins joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, we should say lots of palace intrigue here, lots of quotes from unnamed former White House and Trump aides, and lots of denials from the Trump White House, but also reporting that people can see with their own eyes about Ivanka and Don Jr. So let's talk first about this concept. As you write, it's a concept of dynasties and one that's hard to control. The Kennedys were a dynasty with much tragedy, no second president. The Bushes were a dynasty and didn't get the scion, you know, George H.W. Bush wanted. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the thing about political dynasties is that the patriarch of the dynasty doesn't always have the control over who succeeds him. In the case of the Bushes, for example, you had Jeb as the heir apparent. He was kind of the smart one, the well-behaved one, the one that George H.W. saw as his successor. But George W. kind of shocked everyone by beating him to the White House. And what you're seeing now with the Trumps is that President Trump has always made it very clear that Ivanka is his favorite. And when the family business was in real estate and television and media, Ivanka was clearly being groomed to be the next face of the Trump empire. But what happened is on Election Day in 2016, the family business changed. And now it's about politics. And in the political realm, Don Jr. has sort of emerged as this MAGA hero, where he's building his own grassroots fan base while Ivanka is toiling away in the White House and finding herself, I think, a little out of her depth.
Well, and let's explain how startling that is. You say President Trump has made no bones about the fact that she's his favorite. And it was because she was beautiful, buttoned up, presented herself beautifully. Mm-hmm. Don Jr. was kind of, you know, relegated to the sidelines in the way you describe it. His father was kind of frustrated with him.
Yeah, and this goes back to even his childhood. When Donald Trump had that very high-profile divorce with their mother, Ivana, Ivanka got closer to her father, and Don kind of pushed him away. In the years that followed, Don developed a kind of reputation within the family for breaking from expectations and not always being quick to do what his father wanted from him. So Trump always saw Ivanka as somebody who was good at generating positive coverage for him, for his company, and most importantly, was willing to kind of do what her father wanted her to do.
Well, and so bring us back. You mentioned election night. The Trump family and friends were so sure that he was going to lose that they already started plans for a Trump television channel. They had to quickly write the speech he was going to give. His aide, Steve Miller, started to write it, and it was too revengeful. And so the children took over and wrote the president's speech. Ivanka went on to be considered kind of the Trump whisperer. There's one story that you tell of how she guided her father through an issue that involved the Vice President Pence.
Right. Early in Trump's presidency, a number of White House officials began drafting an executive order aimed at protecting religious conservatives. This was a big part of his campaign promise and especially important to kind of conservative evangelicals. And what happened is as a draft began circulating, Ivanka realized that it would be viewed as anti-LGBT, which was kind of off-brand for her. And so she went to work very quietly but very forcefully lobbying her father not to sign that draft order. She even recruited, I'm told, the gay CEO of Apple, Tim Cook, to personally lobby Trump. In the end, her efforts worked. I write about a scene in the president's private study where he was discussing this executive order with a number of advisors, and Vice President Pence was kind of making the case for the executive order, and Donald Trump finally snapped at him and put him back in his place, and it was clear to everybody in that room that Ivanka had won.
Well, she won in that moment and in many others. And then you go on to detail how the president actually became frustrated with her and her husband, Jared Kushner, calling them New York liberals. She fell from favor.
What I'm told is that Trump grew tired of the incessant lobbying. They were certainly more moderate. And a lot of the things that they were advising him to do were just out of step with Trump's base. And I'm told one of the kind of breaking points was when they were lobbying him to change his position on withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accords. And when he did finally withdraw from those climate accords, it's sort of tarnished the idea that Ivanka was this Trump whisperer. And it kind of revealed the extent to which her influence in the White House and on her father was waning.
Well, meanwhile, there's Don Jr., who had been, by your accounts and others, we should say, kind of seething on the sidelines, who got caught up in, as you write, the fiasco in the Trump Tower when he was told that there were some Russians that had some dirt on Hillary Clinton and he organized the meeting. You write that watching cable news coverage of the fiasco from the West Wing, Trump shook his head, said with a sigh, "He's not the sharpest knife in the drawer." But then Don Jr. grabbed his MAGA hat and started traveling the country. He became the person who was most welcome at rallies of Republicans, divorced from his wife, started dating the Fox News figure, Kimberly Guilfoyle, and became a superstar out in the hustings.
That's right. Don had always struggled to get his father's respect. And because he wasn't really invited to join the president in the White House or in the administration and was kind of on the outside looking in, he figured the best way to be in the action was to go out on the campaign trail. And what he found was that he was actually pretty good at campaigning. He connected with Trump's base in a way that Ivanka and Jared certainly never have. He talked about hunting and fishing. He's an avid outdoorsman. And most importantly, he kind of came to mimic his father's style. It's almost like he's practiced his father's mannerisms in the mirror. He makes this similarly transgressive, kind of outrageous comments and jokes that rile up the MAGA crowds. And he's really become something of a right-wing superstar, while Ivanka has been inside the White House doing her thing and away from the spotlight to a large extent.
Well, and you report that North Dakota Senator Kevin Cramer told you, "I could very easily see him entering politics." There was a poll taken privately in Montana that showed that 75% of the state's Republicans viewed him favorably. He's thinking of running somewhere in the Mountain West where his love of guns and hunting will be good for him. Has the president shifted on this as well, or is he watching in horror as the child he hadn't thought might succeed him may?
You know, I tell a story about a family gathering where There was a Republican senator present who heard the president asking Don Jr. about whether he was using the Trump plane, kind of giving him a hard time. And this Republican senator interjected and said, you know, without Don's work in the 2018 midterms, we might not have kept the majority of the Senate. Mm-hmm. And Trump seemed pleased by that. Yeah. From what I've heard, Ivanka's still the favorite, but he recognizes Don as a useful tool, certainly in the reelection campaign. It was notable that in the president's reelection campaign, Don was there on the stage warming up the crowd in advance of the president's speech while Ivanka and Jared sat in the audience and watched.
Well, and here is Don Jr. at another rally in Michigan.
There is not a single economic metric where we are not better off today than we were just 2 short years ago. Name one. It cannot be done.
So, McKay Cobbins, one last thought. You quote from an unnamed source the president saying that his son Don Jr. isn't the sharpest knife in the drawer. There are a lot of metaphorical knives in this White House, a lot of people leaving and flinging them in the backs of those they've left behind. How confident are you in your reporting of this scenario that you set up, this infighting between President Trump's children and this hope that there will be a successor?
Very confident in the reporting. Obviously, this took a long time. I spent several months working on this story, interviewed dozens of people close to the family, and was aware of the fact that there are different people with different agendas. But it's also true that this is a very sensitive subject, one that a lot of people are wary of going on the record to discuss. And so I think it's an important story to tell.
And again, we add, it's a story that the White House is denying. That's McKay Cobbins. His article in The Atlantic is Succession. We'll link you to it at hearandnow.org. McKay, thank you.
Thank you.
And a note, in videos of Don Jr. at rallies, fans yell out 2024. He gives them the thumbs up.
British Airways has canceled nearly all its flights for a second day because of a pilot strike. This is the first time the airline's pilots have gone on strike. Nearly 2,000 flights have been grounded after pilots rejected a deal that would boost their pay. They say they also want to share in the company's strong profits. BA's chief executive Alex Crew says the deal is already generous and the strike punishes customers. An estimated 280,000 people have now been affected. The pilots go back to work tomorrow, but another strike is planned for later this month. Well, now to a small airline that hopes to make aviation history with a plane that flies without fossil fuels. Bruce Gellerman of member station WBUR tells us what Massachusetts-based Cape Air is up to.
Aircraft mechanic Jack Fidel has been with Cape Air for 7 years. Soon, he'll begin the process to get his wings and be licensed to pilot the airline's fleet of classic Cessna's 402s.
It's a nice airplane. They're all nice airplanes. Yep, they're workhorses for us.
Fidel starts and taxis a 9-seater twin-engine Cessna in front of Cape Air's maintenance hangar at Barnstable Municipal Airport. The Massachusetts company has 88 of these piston-powered planes. Cape Air founder and CEO Dan Wolf.
From a safety standpoint, we have always held that the type of flying we do, a lot of which is over water, a lot of it at night, a lot of it in challenging weather conditions, should always be done with a twin-engine airplane.
But times change, and Cape Air is changing ahead of them. It's the first airline in the world to order commercial airplanes with three engines, three electric battery-powered engines.
The name of the airplane is the Alice. It's got a motor on each wingtip, facing back, pushing, and then it's got a pusher on the tail. So three motors, really innovative design. It sort of looks Jetson-ish, if that's a word.
A full-scale prototype of all-electric Alice was unveiled this June at the Paris Air Show.
This is a very, very different way to fly a plane. It's really a paradigm shift.
Omer Bar-Yohe is CEO of Eviation, the Israeli company that's designing the battery-powered Alice, and plans to test and produce it in the U.S. The airplane has a sleek, lightweight composite body, elongated futuristic cockpit, V-shaped tail, and large oval windows.
This plane was built for a smoother, crisper ride for the passenger.
And quieter, like an electric car. The lithium-ion batteries will provide instant power to the rear-facing propellers so Alice can take off on shorter runways, fly 50% faster and further than Cape Air's current fleet of Cessnas.
It opens up a lot of doors for us.
CEO Dan Wolf believes the 9-passenger, all-electric plane with a range of 650 miles could mean more frequent flights to more places and possibly lower ticket prices.
The preliminary numbers look like the direct operating costs are going to be about 40% of what we're currently spending. So the maintenance will be lower because you're dealing with a very simple electric motor versus a very complex carbon fuel burning engine. And you're dealing with electricity, which ultimately should be a lot cheaper than fuel.
And battery-powered Alice will be a lot friendlier to the environment than climate-disrupting gas-guzzling planes, which emit 2% of global greenhouse gases, especially if Alice's energy source is renewable, nearby, and produced out of thin air.
The largest offshore wind project being proposed in the United States is being proposed just south of Martha's Vineyard, east of Rhode Island. And we are talking with the folks at Vineyard Wind who are building that project to procure energy from them.
Federal regulators have delayed construction of Vineyard Wind, pending a more extensive review of the offshore wind farm's environmental impacts. But even without the giant offshore wind farm, Cape Air could source renewable electricity for Alice's batteries even closer to home. Jim Wolf, director of sustainability at Cape Air, takes out keys to unlock a rarely used door that opens onto the roof of the company headquarters overlooking Barnstable Airport. And Jim and his brother, CEO Dan Wolf, walk towards an array of solar panels. 10 years ago, when it was installed, this was the third largest solar collector in Massachusetts. Today, it's relatively small, but it still puts out enough electricity to run Cape Air's offices. And one day, with added panels, it might be used to extend the life of Alice's batteries after they've served their 2-year flight span.
In the future, these batteries in these planes could be a very, very good way to go when you age them out.
Instead of recycling Alice's old lithium batteries, says Jim Wolf, they could be recharged with the company's rooftop solar and reused on the ground.
You can have the batteries from the planes being back up for the plane to plug into, because I think that's the way we're talking about doing it.
Alice, the electric battery-powered airplane, will be something new under the sun and in the air. Cape Air expects its first Alice aircraft will be making its maiden carbon-free flight and enter regular service by 2023. For Here and Now, I'm Bruce Gellerman.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.